Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In the new documentary, Drugs, we learn that Americans spent an estimated $450 billion on prescription drugs in 2016. One in five Americans cannot afford the medicine they need. Many need medicine to survive. Last year, five of the major pharmaceutical companies made $50 billion in profits. The documentary Drugs begins with this somber line. By the time you will have finished watching this film, which is just over an hour, at least seven Americans will have died, not because of bad luck or genetics or tragedy, but because they could not pay what the market will bear. To talk more about drugs and how we got here, we're joined by three guests featured in the film. Jamie Love is director of Knowledge Ecology International, a nonprofit that searches for better outcomes to the management of knowledge resources. Jamie Love is a producer of the documentary Drugs. Hi, Jamie. Thank you so much for making this film, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Dr. Jerry Avorn, professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and chief of the Division of Pharmacoepidemiology and Pharmacoeconomics at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Hi, Dr. Avorn. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for your work.
You're very welcome. Glad to be here.
Great to have you. David Mitchell is president and founder of Patients for Affordable Drugs, an independent patient organization focused exclusively on achieving policy changes to lower the price of prescription drugs. David Mitchell is a patient with an incurable but treatable blood cancer. He depends on very expensive drugs for his survival, and he expects to be in continuous treatment until he dies. Hi, David. Thank you so much for joining us.
Rose, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. David, I want to start off with you because this is so personal for you. I mean, I'm guessing it's personal for almost all of us. But for you especially, I understand that every time you are treated, the drugs that you're on cost $10,000.
I wish.
Even more than that.
Every time I get treatment right now, the drugs cost $24,000.
Oh, wow.
That's just for the two main cancer drugs. I get a whole bunch of drugs in addition to that. I'm very, very grateful for these drugs. They're keeping me alive. But the fact is, this journey as a cancer patient dealing with these drugs has taught me one irrefutable truth, and that is that drugs don't work if people can't afford them.
And you and your wife, who is a cancer survivor, decided to start Patients for Affordable Drugs to try to tackle this crisis.
That's correct. I'd been doing health policy work in Washington, D.C. for longer than I care to admit. And I became increasingly frustrated as a patient because there were no patient groups speaking out on the issue of drug prices. And the reason they don't is more than four out of five take contributions from the drug companies. Now, they put that money to good use. They use it for patient education and patient support. We need those services. But on the issue of drug pricing, they are constrained. And so one morning I woke up and had an epiphany, and I went down for coffee with my wife and asked her if I could retire, if I could work for free, and if we could try and do this. And thus, Patients for Affordable Drugs was born.
And David, what would be at the top of your list? Senator Bernie Sanders and Congressman Ro Khanna recently introduced the Prescription Drug Price Relief Act, and we'll talk about that throughout the show. But what would you do to reform this system?
I would start with three principal reforms. Number one, we are the only wealthy nation in the world that doesn't negotiate over the price of prescription drugs. Our government is a price taker. The companies dictate prices to our government. We should be using our collective buying power, and Medicare should be able to negotiate directly with the drug companies to lower prices. Two, we should be addressing secrecy and secrecy that's practiced by the pharmacy benefit managers who run our prescription drug insurance programs. They do all of their business in the dark. We can't see what's going on inside them. They're supposed to negotiate on my behalf, but I don't know how much of what they negotiate they keep, how much they give to an insurer, if any of it reaches me or other Medicare beneficiaries. And finally, we should be reforming abuses that take place in our patent systems. We give drug companies a period of exclusivity to have them recoup their investment in innovation, the risk they took, and so they can make a big profit during that period of exclusivity. But at the end of it, they're supposed to allow generics to come to market and let competition and a free market drive down the price. Frequently, they don't do that. They use a variety of tactics to game the system, extend their patents and exclusivity, thereby making drugs unaffordable for millions and millions of people.
And that is David Mitchell. He's president and founder of Patients for Affordable Drugs. He is featured in the film Drugs. The S is a dollar sign, and it'll be streaming this Saturday on Amazon and YouTube, so it'll be available for everyone to see. You can watch the trailer at yourcallradio.org or find more information drugsthefilm.com. We're also joined by Dr. Jerry Avorn, professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Avorn, what would you add to that list? What would you do to reform the system?
Well, I think David set forth the issues really very well, and with the extra poignancy that this is not just something he studies, this is something he lives, and his very life is on the line. And I really appreciate his comments and what he's been doing to bring this issue out there. I think an important additional point to raise is that somehow the nation has bought into the idea that if the drug companies don't get whatever they want in terms of what they can charge, then they, as the source of all drug discovery and innovation, will stop doing that, and then we're all going to die. And I think what that misses, and we see this, of course, in the TV campaigns that the pharmaceutical industry puts on about discovery of new drugs. And I cannot tell you how many times when I'm in conversations with policymakers about somehow making drugs more affordable, as every other country on earth does, I hear, well, we don't want to limit innovation. And I think that the point that listeners need to really understand is that while there are some very good scientists and drug companies, and they do good work and should be rewarded for that, an enormous amount of the science that leads to the development of new drugs happens with funding from the National Institutes of Health, which is, of course, taxpayer dollars. And it goes to nonprofit academic institutions like the one that I work with at Harvard Medical School and Brigham and Women's Hospital that are nonprofit organizations where scientists try to get public support, do their research, and then when it looks like that research has led to a marketable product through a variety of steps we don't have time to get into, suddenly it becomes the property of a drug company that has bought it, often at a really pretty low price, and then sells it at, as David said, whatever they damn please to charge for it. And no other country does it like that, and that's one of the reasons that we have such expensive drugs. And in a sense, the taxpayer pays twice, once for the research that develops the drug, and then to be able to obtain the drug, whether through Medicare or Medicaid or their own insurance.
This is a really important part of the film, and Jamie, you and the other filmmakers did a great job explaining this, because we hear over and over again, and you have so many clips in the film Drugs, from these executives saying that we need to spend money on research and development, otherwise we're not going to be able to cure all of the diseases that we're dealing with. And as Dr. Avorn just stated, the United States has the largest federally funded science program in the world, with $32 billion invested annually. And these funds are essential to research. So again, I think this is important to just repeat. You have the NIH, and then you have academic institutions working on the drug. So they're using taxpayer dollars to work on the drug. And then you need the capital and the infrastructure, which the government and academia lack, and that's when the company steps in. And then the drug gets approval from the FDA, and once that happens, it's complete, and then the marketing and the commercials begin. So, Jamie, can you talk about why this is such an important part of the film?
Well, as was mentioned, it's certainly the case that the federal government plays an important role in funding biomedical research, and not only the United States government. I mean, you have governments throughout the world which also play an important role. The NIH in the United States is the most important federal agency. There's also sorts of other agencies within the U.S. government, from the National Science Foundation to the Navy, the Department of Energy. There's a big government effort, and there's also a big nonprofit effort where people make donations, do marathons, things like that, to raise money for medical research. That said, I would say that in our opinion, in my opinion, that the role of the private sector in making investments has been very important, and I think we depend upon that. So from the point of view of my organization and groups, some of the groups I work with, like the Union for Affordable Cancer Treatment, which is a patient group which is not funded by drug companies but focuses on drug prices and accessibility, I think that we're interested in this idea of progressively delinking the incentives that are available to private drug companies to make investments from the price of the drug. Right now, the high price of the drug is held out as the primary incentive for private companies to make the investment, but it creates havoc in the patient community. It creates fiscal toxicity, and it's really hard to manage the prices because whenever you take measures to lower the prices that companies claim, you're hurting R&D, so it pits innovation against access. So what we're encouraging policymakers to do is to have a program which explains how, when you progressively lower prices, you are also protecting innovation, not through high prices, but through other mechanisms, through some combination of direct funding like the NIH does, subsidies for clinical trials such as the orphan drug tax credit, which was cut under the Trump administration, or things like innovation inducement prizes, which are rewarding successful development but are not linked to the price of the drug.
How would you regulate the price of drugs to prevent companies from charging whatever they want? What would that look like?
Well, we've worked with members of Congress. You mentioned the bill, the Sanders and Kanaan bill that deals with which has a robust compulsory licensing authority, and it has several measures in there which they would use to trigger measures where the government would end the monopoly. I want to go back to this idea of people talk about Medicare negotiating prices. We think, of course, Medicare should be involved in negotiation of prices, but there's two things I think are important to remember. One, Medicare only covers about 16% of the U.S. population, and there's the other 84% of the population is pretty important as well. So we think whatever measures are taken on drug prices should not be limited to the Medicare population. Secondly, in countries where they do negotiate prices, often they do that by threatening to withhold coverage, and that puts the patients at risk. That's a huge problem right now in the UK with around cystic fibrosis drugs, or the drugs that my wife takes, which is Kadcyla, which is a very expensive breast cancer drug, not available in some countries. What we'd like the government to do, if they think the price is excessive, is to put the monopoly at risk, not the patients. So we think the idea that you improve your bargaining position and you protect the patients by saying that if you can't reach an agreement on an acceptable price, that you would terminate the legal monopoly and allow competition to take place. That really ensures that as you take measures to expand prices, that you would not be in a situation where the company could blackmail you by refusing to provide the drugs at a certain price.
That is Jamie Love. He's director of Knowledge Ecology International and producer of the documentary Drugs, which will be
co-producer. I'm not really the
co-producer. Okay, co-producer.
I would have to say I don't want to overstate my role in the film. The producers did a lot more work than I did. They were kind to give me a co-producer credit.
Okay, he's co-producer of the documentary Drugs. It'll be streaming on Saturday on Amazon and YouTube, and you can find more information, drugsthefilm.com. The trailer is also at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by David Mitchell, president and founder of Patients for Affordable Drugs, an organization that focuses exclusively on achieving policy changes to lower the price of prescription drugs. And Dr. Jerry Avorn is professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and chief of the Division of Pharmacoepidemiology and Pharmacoeconomics at Brigham and Women's Hospital. And if you'd like to join us, if you have a story about drug costs, maybe the price changed, are you able to afford the drugs you need? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. And let's talk about the EpiPen, because this got a lot of media attention. But I think the film does such a good job of really laying out what happened. So in 2007, Mylan Pharmaceuticals acquired EpiPen. This is a device that a lot of children especially use to inject measured doses of epinephrine. And since the acquisition, the prices have drastically risen. So when Mylan acquired EpiPen in 2007, the price was about $50. And then 10 years later, it was $600. David, since you are founder of Patients for Affordable Drugs, talk about why this is an example of these runaway prices. I mean, it was increased for no reason, and it affected so many people across the country.
Yep. And I would urge Dr. Avorn to chime in behind me. Just briefly, I will say that the reason this is possible is because the drug companies have spent billions of dollars over decades to build up a regulatory framework that enables them to exercise control over prices. The regulatory framework we have for pharmaceutical drugs in this country is not built to serve patients like me being kept alive with a drug that costs $300,000 a year. It's built to serve the profit-making demands of the drug industry. And pharma and others in the drug supply chain all are incredibly wealthy, incredibly profitable, and they fight using, I'm not exaggerating, billions of dollars of lobbying money and campaign contributions. They buy off physician groups. They buy patient groups. The tentacles of pharma reach everywhere, and at the end is a big wad of cash at the end of each of those tentacles. And so you have a situation where Heather Bresch and Mylan Labs could acquire EpiPen and just start jacking up the price with no restraint until the government hauled them before Congress and stepped in. And Jerry should tell a little bit more of that story in terms of the details of exactly what happened.
Thank you, David. I'm happy to do so, or I guess I should say I'm sad to do so. The EpiPen is an example of how our patent system for drugs has really kind of gone crazy. And as David mentioned, this is a drug that has been around for many, many decades, epinephrine. It was discovered back in the early to mid-20th century. And what we have in EpiPen is a neat system of delivering it so that for example, a child having an allergic attack that can be very serious or life-threatening can jab it into their thigh and get the epinephrine into their system, and that's a good thing, of course. But the fact that through a whole variety of complicated patents, it was possible for Mylan to surround that drug with all of these patents that block the ability of anybody else to take this very, very old medication and come up with a way of injecting it into the body such that it was very hard for competitors to get on the scene. And the whole point of our economy is that and of the patent laws is that after an innovator company has been able to get its fair due by having essentially a monopoly right over the drug for a period of years, and that's fine. If they discover something good, they ought to be able to profit from it. But the idea is that when that patent expires, the whole point of the patent system, as per the Constitution where it began, is that it then becomes available for other people to manufacture that product. And the real salt in the wound with EpiPen is that Mylan didn't do anything really to develop the drug any further. As was mentioned, they simply bought the rights to it and then jacked up the price simply because they could. This is a very simple drug, a very simple delivery system, but the patents plus an awful lot of lobbying enable them to do these unconscionable increases in cost such that a lot of kids and parents who are at risk of these allergic attacks were not able to get it. The other example is the so-called pharma bro, Martin Shkreli, who got into the news a number of years ago by taking a drug that is used for toxoplasmosis, a rare condition that often strikes people who have HIV. And because he was able to buy the rights to it, and again, this is a drug that is decades old, he didn't do anything to discover or improve it, but he was able to increase the price 5,000% just because he could. So one of the things we need to do as a country is really take a better look at the way the patent laws have been abused and see what we can do to make these drugs available once their patents have expired and not let the lawyers and lobbyists manage to keep control of it and charge whatever they want as long as they can get away with it.
In the documentary Drugs, we meet families who rely on the EpiPen for their kids. One mom with two kids said it cost $600 for one set of EpiPens, and she needed several sets on hand at home, in their kid's backpack, at school. One of her kids plays football. The coach needs it. And again, the price went from about $50 10 years ago to $600. And in the film, we also learn that Heather Bresch, the CEO of Mylan, the company that acquired EpiPen, in 2007, her salary was $2.4 million. As the price of the EpiPen swelled, so did her salary, all the way to $18.9 million. And there are clips in the film of Heather Bresch being grilled about the cost of the EpiPen. What is the status of Heather Bresch, and how much is the EpiPen today? Whatever happened with all of those hearings? Dr. Avorn?
I think it may be that Jamie or David is more up to date on the current status of that particular product.
But,
David?
This is Jamie. Let me...
Jamie.
Just comment. I think the EpiPen story is... it's an illustration why the focus that some people have, you hear in the Congress sometimes, of focusing on Medicare negotiations doesn't go far enough. Because the EpiPen was, a lot of the patients that used EpiPen were definitely not on Medicare. They're younger patients. And the other thing is that the U.S. is unusual in the sense they allow people to increase the price of drugs once they're on the market. So as Professor Avery mentioned, that there was a huge increase in the price for something that was already on the market. In Canada, a lot of other countries, once you have a product registered, you can't automatically just jack up the price however you want. You may have to be limited to something like the cost of living index or something like that. That doesn't really affect the initial price, maybe, that you put on a product, but it does constrain the ability of a company to have the kind of price increases that you saw with Martin Shkreli or with the EpiPen. Another thing that was pointed out, though, is that the patents are on the delivery of an older drug. And you see this in the anti-opioid medicines. You see this in asthma inhalers. You see this in the EpiPen. A lot of things like that where you'll have an older generic product, but there'll be a limited competition for the drug because you have to get it through a particular kind of, or it's preferred to get it through a particular, this happens for some diabetes products and some insulin products as well, the delivery mechanism. So looking at the patent landscape and the patent thickets and some of the anti-competitive behavior on patenting the delivery mechanism is something that I think policymakers need to take a harder look at because it doesn't really have the same value in terms of innovation is the drug itself, which is older and has been around for a while. With asthma inhalers, they used to be very cheap in the United States, and then now you have to have a a particular, I think an HFA or something like that. I forget the exact name for it, but you have to have a particular delivery mechanism in the United States. So asthma inhalers are like $60 or something like that, sometimes for the copayment with insurance for some patients. For things that you can buy for about $2.50 in Europe, the same company, the same inhaler, the same delivery mechanisms. And that's because the United States, as was mentioned earlier, has really gone overboard in the proliferation of patents on things that come after the actual active ingredient has long become a generic product. Now, how is Mylan doing, and how is she doing? I think she's doing fine. I think that they have over time brought in an authorized generic at a lower price, and the price is still really excessive for what it is. And I think that one thing I think that may happen is there's talk that Elizabeth Warren may introduce a bill that will have the government more directly involved in serving as a backstop manufacturer if you have an area where there's a lack of competition for a product, starting certainly with areas drugs that are off patent, like the one that Martin Shirelli was involved with, or some of the anti-opioid medicines. But it could also be, in certain cases, it could be products that are under patent as well.
Well, if anyone takes the EpiPen or knows anyone who does, you might want to share this information. CBS just reported that the generic drug maker Sandoz is going to start selling an alternative to the EpiPen in the United States early next year, and it'll be less expensive than the Mylan EpiPen.
I think the problem with the EpiPen story was that a lot of school personnel, first responders, and people like that were trained to use a particular device to use it, which was something that, you know, you had to be alert when you were doing it. And I think that they felt that it was one of the things that had retarded the introduction by competitors.
Jamie Love is Director of Knowledge Ecology International. David Mitchell is President and Founder of Patients for Affordable Drugs. And Dr. Jerry Avorn is Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. Today we are talking about the new documentary, Drugs. It'll be available online this Saturday. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. We're going to take a quick break. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Remember Obamacare? The deadline to sign up for coverage under the Affordable Care Act for next year is days away. Enrollment rates are down, but healthcare drove much of the record turnout in the midterms. We'll take a closer look at the numbers, what help is available, and how recent changes might impact the coverage that millions now rely on. Next time on 1A.
You can hear 1A 1/2 hour from now at 11 o'clock this morning, right after your call here on 91.7 KALW. Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. 8255, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@klw.org. You may leave a comment at the show's website, set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org. You can also tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will talk about the massive protests and social unrest in Paris. We'll also discuss coverage of the climate summit in Poland and the impacts of the Trump administration's expansion of oil, natural gas, and coal production. If you have a guest idea or a show idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. Today we're talking about a new documentary called Drugs. We learned that Americans spent $450 billion on prescription drugs in 2016. Last year, five of the major pharmaceutical companies made $50 billion in profits. And this film will be available online on Saturday. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by David Mitchell, President and Founder of Patients for Affordable Drugs. Jamie Love is Director of Knowledge Ecology International. Dr. Jerry Avorn is Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. And let's hear from Andy in Redwood City. Hi, Andy. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose, and hello to your guest. It's great that you've taken on this subject. I'm a diabetic. I lost my job in 2010. I was on COBRA for a long time. Then my COBRA ran out. I still didn't have work, didn't have insurance. I had to start buying my insulin and other drugs for diabetes myself. And I watched the drug prices just skyrocket as I was doing that. And it basically ruined me financially and has destroyed my life. And I watched Humalog and Solastar. Humalog was a guy, Azor, who's now in the administration, Eli Lilly, just double and triple in price. And the other drugs, like I said, Solastar, Lantos, just go crazy in price. And I just want to bring up, there's a local congresswoman. Her name is Anna Eshoo. In 2009, she pushed a bill called H.R. 1548, Pathway for Biosimilars Act. That bill really tightened up the patents for people and made it much easier for the drug companies to keep extending their patents. You know, something like insulin that's been around since the 1920s should cost almost nothing. It should be generic. It shouldn't be on patent at all. It should be as cheap as any drug ever made, but it's not. And Anna Eshoo, with this Biosimilars Act, after that happened, really destroyed the generic market. And people should know that and understand that. In the midst of Santa Clara County is a woman that shouldn't be near the halls of government. She should have been booted out years ago in California District 18. She was a sponsor of that bill. And another, if you don't think she's murdering people and murdering diabetics, even NPR itself on September 1st came out with a piece, Insulin's High Cost Leads to Lethal Rationing, about a gentleman named Alex Rashawn Smith who came off his mother's health care. He was a diabetic, couldn't afford his insulin, and he died from ketoacidosis at like 27 years old or something like that. You know, where he just couldn't get enough insulin, and his blood turned to acid, and he died. So if you don't think people like Anna Eshoo in office are murderers, you got to think something else in that friggin' district and get her the heck out of there.
Well, Andy, thank you for calling. I completely understand why you're angry about all of this. I mean, in the film, a few people who are interviewed about the difficulty of getting their drugs, they pass away during the filming of drugs. And we also learn that by the time we have done this show about an hour, let's say a little over an hour, about 7 people in the United States will have died, not because of bad luck, but because they cannot pay what the market will bear. David, Jamie, Dr. Avorn, are you familiar with this Anna Eshoo bill?
I certainly am, because I was involved in the I was active in the debate, and I'm sure Jerry was too, but I was active in the debate when they were considering that legislation. It was really a setback when the Eshoo bill replaced the proposal by Henry Waxman. Henry Waxman had a much simpler pathway and a shorter term of exclusivity that was supported by President Obama. And then Anna Eshoo challenged him, and actually he was the chairman of the committee, and she had a majority of votes against Chairman Waxman on that provision. It was considered one of the real setbacks. Another person that worked that lobbied on behalf of the biopharmaceutical industry on that bill was Howard Dean, who was on the payroll of Bio at the time.
Yeah, and if I can just weigh in, I understand why the caller was so upset. Insulin is a terrible and an outrageous story in this country. We have an oligopoly, 3 companies that have seized control of a 100-year-old drug. They raised their prices in lockstep. The prices of insulin have gone up 300% over the last 10 years. With regard to Anna Eshoo, unfortunately, Congresswoman Eshoo has taken more money from the pharmaceutical and health products industry than any other member of the U.S. House of Representatives. She does the bidding of the drug companies, and every American is paying more for prescription drugs because of actions Anna Eshoo has taken in Congress. And the idea that there was an effort to set the length of time that companies bringing biologic drugs to market would get, to set it at 7 years. That was the proposal from Congressman Waxman, the Obama administration. Anna Eshoo opposed that, as Jamie said, and managed to win a victory for the drug companies that made the exclusivity period run 12 years for biologics. This hurt people in this country. And NASU needs to be called to account for that. In fact, our organization actually ran advertising, direct mail, into her district during the last election to make people aware of her actions.
And David, I understand it's the first time your group... sorry about that. David, it's the first time your organization has launched an ad targeting a Democrat?
We ran ads against Democrats last cycle. We ran ads against Anna Eshoo. We ran ads against Senator Tom Carper from Delaware, who is also a reliable vote for the drug companies. We ran ads in favor of people, Republican and Democrat, who are doing the right thing to lower drug prices, and we ran ads against people who are not doing the right thing to lower drug prices, regardless of their party. We actually did five races that would be what you would call pro-Republican and four that you would be you would call pro-Democrat. We spent about $10 million.
Who else is working on bringing down the cost of pharmaceutical drugs and taking on these corporations? We hear about Bernie Sanders pretty regularly, but who else?
Well, I this is Jamie, and I'm sure others have a lot of insight in this, but there's I think if you look at almost every Democrat who's running for president right now, and that's a very large number of people, they're all co-sponsoring various bills that are moving things in the right direction. You have over 100 co-sponsors of the Lloyd Doggett bill in the House of Representatives on Medicare negotiations. And the Doggett bill also includes a robust compulsory licensing authority, which is really a change and a hardening of the positions by the Democrats in the House. You have Elizabeth Warren, senators from all over the place. Amy Klobuchar was in the film, of course. I think you have Cory Booker, who used to be, more sympathetic to farm. He's from New Jersey, but he's moved in this direction. I think that the critical thing will be also it has to be bipartisan. You have to have really Republicans engaged in this, and I think that's really important. I wanted to say one thing though about the insulin, and that is that in the experiment that Secretary Azar has to introduce international reference pricing for certain drugs in Part B of Medicare, he was very artfully excluded insulin because insulin is a Part D of Medicare medication. And so Secretary Azar comes from Lilly, the company that one of the three members, major members of what some people describe as a cartel, Lilly, Sanofi, and Novo. So I think it needs to be pointed out that when he came up with this effort to make Trump look like he was doing something about drug prices that's focused on Part B of Medicare, he definitely left out insulin, which is a major problem.
Jamie Love is Director of Knowledge Ecology. Go ahead, Dr. Avorn.
Okay, I was just going to say this is an important part of the conversation because it illustrates how really out of control we have gotten in terms of A, patents, and B, Congress. Because the patent law, most other countries on Earth do not have this problem, but because they've structured their rules and regulations in a much more sane way. The drug companies are happy to do business in those countries because they still make a fine profit. They wouldn't be there if they didn't. But no other country has had its governing structure so captured by lobbyists. And as we know, the pharmaceutical lobbying effort is one of the largest in Washington of all the different lobbying efforts that are going on. And they really have an open door into the offices of most people in Congress and most people in the administration. So when you ask, how do we have such a crazy system? It's because they have actually bought the laws and regulations that they like. And if we want to change that, we need to, as we've just been hearing, change the people who have managed to sell their souls to lobbyists from the industry and put people in who are going to be fair to the drug companies, but also be fair to patients as well. This is not about ending the free enterprise system. It's actually about making the free enterprise system work the way it's supposed to, where you don't have monopolies that get extended and extended and extended, and all kinds of external ways of putting the thumb on the scale so that companies can get whatever they want. And as I said, most countries have figured this out. We just have managed to set up laws that really defeat us at every turn.
And can I weigh in with one more thing, Rose?
Sure. David.
Just to make sure we have some political balance, at least political balance from my perspective. There are leaders in the Congress who are Republicans. Senator Grassley would be counted among them, who have shown real leadership in terms of trying to do what Jerry Avorn just described, which is to allow free markets and competition to work as intended in order that we get generics timely and that those generics have the impact of lowering prices. There are folks in the House of Representatives on the Republican side also who have stood up for reforms. I'll be meeting with one of them this afternoon. Also, I am not as harsh as Jamie is about Secretary Azar. Secretary Azar has brought forth a remarkable proposal, actually. It's unprecedented in the government to use reference pricing for these very expensive Part B drugs like I take. They're infused drugs administered by doctors and in hospitals. And it would actually lower the price of drugs, not stop them from going up, lower them for these very expensive Part B drugs from about 180% of what other wealthy nations pay to about 126% of what other wealthy nations pay. And so I do not agree with everything anybody does. I certainly don't agree with Democrat Anna Eshoo. I don't always agree with the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Alex Azar. But he is doing some things that could bear fruit and actually help provide relief for people on drug prices. And I need to make sure, from my perspective, that we're giving credit where it's due.
And for people who are not on Medicare, can you briefly describe Part B?
Yeah, I can do it quick. There are two ways drugs are covered under Medicare. Part D, DOG, which is for oral drugs. Part B, BOY, which covers drugs that are administered through infusion, like they plug the thing into my arm and pump the drugs in. Drugs that are administered in a physician office or in a hospital, those are covered under Part B, BOY. So there are two different drug programs. Both have drugs that are wildly expensive, prices completely out of control, but they are administered under different programs under Medicare.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, insulin is not administered in a doctor's office. So insulin is an example of one of the things that's not. And I will say this about the Azar's program is that it doesn't cover the whole country. It's going to be kind of a randomized by zip code. So he's proposing a program where people over 65 – that live in half the country that happen to take a small set of drugs that they're going to focus on that's administered in a hospital, will have this demonstration project to see if this works. And I think this is in our work, I'll be more critical than David was on this. I think this is really the minimum that they could do to look as if they were doing things about drug pricing. That said, it is true that the pharmaceutical companies is going bananas and berserk over this program because they're afraid not so much about what Azar has proposed in this particular thing, but they're really looking at how this could scale beyond the demonstration project of half the country, people over 65, for a small number of Part B drugs. They're afraid that it'll be become a bigger norm and across the board.
Well, because they have so much to lose. I mean, that's the other thing. Sorry, we can't see each other, so we're all talking over each other. I just wanted to go back to salaries because, you know, on every show we follow the money. And how do you unravel a system like this? One of the people in the film basically said, this is capitalism. And in order to change this, you need to change the system. You've got a section in the film about these stock buybacks where a company buys its own stock and then opens up a window for executives to cash in. And Gilead is a perfect example. In 2014, after they posted massive profits, they spent $11 billion on stock buybacks. It sent the company's stock through the roof, and the companies cashed in. So in 2014, it was reported that Gilead CEO John Martin made $19 million, which is already massive. But when you look at the proxy statements, you learn that John Martin took home $193 million in 2014 and $232 million in 2015. So these executives have so much to lose with these bills. Dr. Avorn, I mean, like his name escapes me, but like the man in the film said, in order to truly tackle this, you have to really change the system.
Right, and I would suggest changing it from the bottom up and not necessarily from the top down. I think those exorbitant salaries are because the drug companies have so much money flowing in. I think what we as a country need to do is to just figure out how can we make drugs fairly priced, and then the salaries will at some point take care of themselves, because they will not be these billions of dollars sloshing around the company. There are two positive thoughts I wanted to make sure we got to before we're done. One is that there could be a science to this, and in most other countries there is. And by that I mean people in Germany and in Canada and in England look critically at new drugs, and they ask the question, how much of an addition is this to the way we can care for patients in terms of preventing illness, preventing hospitalization? And there is an approach called cost-effectiveness analysis where you basically say, how much better is this than what we had before? There's a very good group in Boston called ICER that does this. And it is possible to analyze every drug from the perspective of, is this really worth the price? And if it is, and many of the new drugs are incredibly valuable, we ought to, as a society, be able to pay it. But if it's not, we shouldn't have regulations like we do, let's say, in Medicaid and Medicare that essentially force those programs to pay for many, many, many drugs, whether they are the best choice or not. So that's one positive way forward, is to just, you know, run the numbers, do the analyses, and come up with a valuable assessment of these drugs, as many countries do. And the second is getting to the doctors. An awful lot of what we doctors know about drugs come from either sales reps or our patients being marinated in these direct-to-consumer drug ads and then saying, I want this, I saw it on television. So for a lot of years, we've been doing something different out of a not-for-profit that we set up, which is essentially marketing the best information to doctors with no drug company money at all. Just saying, you know, this is not such a great drug in terms of what they're charging for it. Why don't you use something else? And that program called ALOSA, which is named after the fish that swim upstream like salmon and herring, ALOSA, has been doing this for a lot of years, and doctors are happy to have our people come into their office and to learn about, hey, I didn't think that was such an overpriced drug. Maybe I shouldn't be using it so much. And we need to move into that space as well and not let the industry dominate the communication to patients and to doctors.
David, what would you like to see done about commercials? In the film, there's a great section about how the United States and New Zealand are the only two countries in the world where pharmaceutical companies can air commercials. And we learned that during Bill Clinton's second term, pharmaceutical ads were deregulated and we got a commercial explosion. What changes would you like to see there? Do you think there will ever be a day when we're not bombarded by pharmaceutical marketing and commercials?
It's possible. First of all, I'd like to see them go away. It's crazy that we allow direct-to-consumer advertising for pharmaceutical drugs. There was a report last year from the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine that recommended that since there are First Amendment problems with telling corporations they can't advertise their products, that what we could do is eliminate the tax deduction. These companies are running $6 billion worth of ads at us, and they're taking a tax deduction for them. If we eliminate the tax deduction, the incentive to run the ads will be reduced. And so we strongly support the idea that we shouldn't be subsidizing bombardment of Americans with these direct-to-consumer ads, and we should eliminate the tax deduction.
We have about 2.5 minutes left. If you can all just tell us, what do you think is the most effective thing people can do on this issue? Why don't you start, David?
Well, we are built to organize patients and their allies to fight back. We are building a community of patients and allies that can be mobilized in support of policy changes at the state and federal level. And if you'll permit me a commercial, if people come to patientsforaffordabledrugs.org, patientsforaffordabledrugs.org, you can learn more about our organization. Costs nothing to join it. We don't take money from anybody who makes money on prescription drugs. We are trying to do one thing and one thing only, and that is organize people across this country to stand up to the drug lobby, help implement reforms that will reduce the price of prescription drugs and provide relief to people in this country.
Jamie Love, final thoughts, about 30 seconds.
I've been working on drug pricing for some time. I know Jerry has too. In my view, the most important thing is to really admit that the current business model for financing research and development is broken. Senator Sanders has a proposal to eliminate the temporary grant of a monopoly on all drugs from day one and replace it with a system of market entry rewards, large cash prizes and rewards for people that are successful drug developers. He's proposed over $100 billion a year to replace the grant of the monopoly, but that would mean that all drugs would be competitive, priced as commodities like aspirin, and they'd be cheap. I think that the key thing is to ask the Congress to support the proposal to have the National Academies of Science evaluate the Sanders proposal.
And Dr. Ahorn, 30 seconds.
Just to be clear, is Sanders' proposal on delinking the incentives for research and development from the price of drugs.
Dr. Ahorn?
What's been clear in this hour and in the film is that, to a large extent, this is a mess we've created ourselves, and we can therefore uncreate it by getting better people in Washington and at the state level, and both Congress and the administration and the regulators like FDA shine a spotlight on them and say, why are you doing this? And there must be a better way that we can go forward and learn from other countries. And I think patients can, at their own level, talk to their doctors about where are you learning about drugs from, and is there another medication that would work as well for me without sending me to the poorhouse? And these are all problems that we can fix as a nation if we can just get out from under the lobbyists and the industry and take back control of what we're doing with medications.
Dr. Jerry Ahorn is professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Jamie Love is director of Knowledge Ecology International. And David Mitchell is president and founder of Patients for Affordable Drugs. Thank you all for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you for doing this, Rose.
Thank you. And you can see the new documentary Drugs online on Saturday. Find more information about it at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.